Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate.
Now listen to this, I'll tell you about the heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopelessness, the meager food, the soul forgot. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron soul.
Live from hell, it's Soma time. Everybody dance. Cultural malaise, hazy, hot, and freaking humiliating. It's Dr. Mark at Culture Vulture here on Soma Time. Number to call to participate in the show, please call tonight because I am playing hurt. My poor, unsupported kidneys have quit on me, and you know your body is mostly water? Well, guess what happens when your kidneys don't filter your blood? That's right. You can't sweat it all out, Sapes. So if you hear me put on, you know, a clip of an old interview, you know where I went. So, wow. Welcome to the July 7th XO edition of Soma Time. We are at the cusp, a solar cusp tonight. We had the lunar eclipse a while back, so there's a lot of woo out there to get to, but basically, if you follow along on somaspace.org and you click down halfway down the page on the coherence calendar, you'll notice that today, being the 7th, is the first of six sections of the summer that we delineate as the solar rhythms change. So that's one of those things why the heat wave, you know, is kind of changing its clothes. We went from heat to humidity, and then there'll be some precipitation here on the East Coast as we move forward, but 7th is the first day that we change rhythms on a solar level during the season, and then we'll do it again in 2 weeks on the 21st, and then again on August 7th and August 21st, so check all that out. The somatic practices will be changing as we go from weight-bearing to non-weight-bearing on our ankles, which is a metaphor for how I'm feeling today, non-weight-bearing. So, anyway, I want to get your reactions to what's been going on. If you have any out there, love to hear about it. 4th of July, we got through that pretty much unscathed, you know. I always kind of think anytime we're waving our flag out there, as Americans are wont to do, I always feel a little vulnerable.
you know, because we kind of got our guard down a little bit while we're blowing things up, you know, and celebrating. So we got through that weekend pretty much for the most part, nothing on the radar that I saw. And as we head into the deep, dark part of the summer, where we kick in, actually, we got a new moon coming up, I think, on the 11th. Let me just glance over here. Yeah, new moon on the 11th this weekend. Start climbing up the mountain again. So, you know, suspicion is high. We've got, I don't even know how many scandals going on at this point. I kind of give up, because what I want to talk about tonight is how, as a culture, as a group of people, our relationship with money has shifted dramatically in the last, say, generation and a half. And we're going to explore that a little bit with our guest at the bottom of the hour, Douglas Rushkoff. From rushcross.com, good friend of mine, nice guy, understands the ethos, i.e., which is half the battle in this dopey culture. Why we do what we do. A lot of it is not even something that you're conscious of, because the targets were set before you got here. So I figured we'd start off tonight with a little lesson from an exo that has transcended his mortal coil and moved on. No, not Elvis, that's Nico. Let's see if I find him here. Yeah. Here's a little minute on George Carlin describing the situation we find ourselves in. Listen and enjoy.
Now, to balance the scale, I'd like to talk about some things that bring us together, things that point out our similarities instead of our differences, because that's all you ever hear about in this country is our differences. That's all the media and the politicians are ever talking about, the things that separate us, things that make us different from one another. That's the way the ruling class operates in any society. They try to divide the rest of the people. They keep the lower and the middle classes fighting with each other so that they, the rich, can run off with all the fucking money. Fairly simple thing happens to work. You know, anything different, that's what they're going to talk about. Race, religion, ethnic and national background, jobs, income, education, social status, sexuality. Anything you can do, keep us fighting with each other so that they can keep going to the bank. You know how I describe the economic and social classes in this country? The upper class keeps all of the money, pays none of the taxes. The middle class pays all of the taxes, does all of the work. The poor are there just to scare the shit out of the middle class. Keep them showing up at those jobs.
All right, so there you go. There's your lesson, your exo truth gliding in on the courtesy of YouTube from George Carlin. And, you know, maybe we'll get into a little of that dynamic because, you know, while all these things are going on, whether it's the healthcare stuff, which is going to, you know, rise up out of the ethers in about a month or two, when that kicks in the fall, we got the midterm elections, you've got scandal after scandal after scandal within the government, hearings going on, Supreme Court stuff, the jobs bill, we had the jobs numbers come out on Friday, we're on too healthy. The G20 thing, which I don't completely understand, it's a G8, it's a G4, it's, you know, it's a GTE. Who knows? All that ever happens in those things is people protest in the streets. And, of course, the BP debacle, which I'll give you. Let's see if I can find my little swine flu song for that. Stinky Boots. That's not there. Oh, Stinky Boots is a good, it's actually a good one. Wow, look at that. All right. I want just a little song for the mess out there. Do I have anything? Let's see. Ooh, Dirty Water. Yeah, we'll go there. It's almost nothing. All right. Let's do this. Just introduce it. Back in black, the oil. Okay, there you go. Enough of that. The latest on the BP cleanup. We're getting to the point now where it's gotten to the cartoon level, really, guys. I mean, we're almost at 80 days of this, and I just think they're stalling until they get the those additional wells built in about a month. And between the pollution in the ocean, pollution on the beaches, and the pollution in the air, I mean, what are we talking here? So let's see if we can get an estimate. BP Boston Mideast talks as weather hampers cleanup. So we had the hurricane last week. That sort of delayed things. And they're back out there now with their skimmers and stuff. And there's Tony Hayward. Love this guy. God, Hunter on the run.
Let's see. Hayward's BP chief executive said business with officials from Dubai. Routine. We're here to talk our existing shareholders. Yeah, it goes back to this corporate stuff. With the CEO in Dubai speaking to the sovereign wealth fund to get some investment, not surprising if there's some enthusiasm in the market on BP shares. BP stock went up. That's the bottom line. Progress on the relief well, seen in the best hope for finally stopping the 79-day-old disaster. So, I mean, I hate to mention it, but, you know, it is there all the time, you know, as a reminder that, and if you take that whole experience as sort of a Rosetta Stone to all the other contradictions between the government, the corporations, the financial sector, and the people, it really kind of like drives home the point of how little they care. About what happens to anyone locally. Because if you could be in Dubai talking to your shareholders about this unmitigated disaster, you know, in the Gulf, and your stock goes up, it's a little nutty. But, you know, that's just one of several. There's the cap and trade bill like that is going to have to surface again. I'm a complete, when it comes to big picture money, it is monopolies to me. It has nothing to do with reality to me because it doesn't really, you know, travel by me much. I'm up here in beautiful downtown Larchmont. I've got, you know, clients that come from all different walks of life. A lot of them work on Wall Street. They ain't looking too healthy. A little stressed. So it's no matter what business you're in right now, this idea of what money is and what money will become is fluid at this point. You know, so I'll give that its due. Mets are going down like a bunch of church chairs. 3-1 in the eighth, one out. They just never, ever, when they give up a run in those middle late innings, they just go down. The Mets, you know, bats go to sleep. Anyway, so I'll just throw a Batman out there in general.
You filthy criminals!
They're out there. You know, whether it's healthcare, whether it's, you know, and again, the unfairness part is what I'll get into with Rushkoff, because we sort of signed up for victimhood with this stuff, giving up a lot of our intrinsic you know, value for the sake of things. And that mentality, again, talking about the cultural part of it, we went from sacrifice and hard work and, you know, purity and ethic and all that stuff, work hard, good education, get a good job, work your way up the ladder, to screw everybody. And that happened over the course of, like I said, a generation and a half, when we figured out that the people that worked the hardest didn't get rewarded. And the ones that basically took that energy and reinvested it skated. There wasn't any penalty for them, you know. And we're kind of living on the other side of that wave right now, in the recovery, summer of recovery, trying to understand that. So let's shift gears and focus on what everyone really wants to talk about, which is LeBron. LeBron! That's right. Tomorrow night, the Elvis of the NBA, and I'll give you a little Elvis here.
There's two things you need to know. I'm the king, and number two is look out, man!
That's right. That's what he basically told everybody in the last couple of weeks. Is, you know, having this primetime special tomorrow night on ESPN to announce what team he's going to be going to, and it has been literally covered wall-to-wall, you know, by all the networks, as if it was, I hate to say it, a Nobel Peace Prize is being awarded with Obama. And it's significant in the sense that if he leaves Cleveland, that economy, which is not too good, has nothing to attract people to except the Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So, you know, I spelunked the YouTube to find this little song here, a little tour of Cleveland. You might have to change some of the lyrics once LeBron packs his bags. But this is what people face out in the Rust Belt on a daily basis, and I don't think any of the stockholders at that BP meeting are tuning into this.
Fun times in Cleveland again.
New Cleveland.
Come on down to Cleveland Town, everyone. Under construction since 1868. See our river that catches on fire.
It's so polluted that all our fish have AIDS. We see the sun almost 3 times a year. This guy has at least 2 DUIs. The flats look like a Scooby-Doo ghost town. Don't slow down in East Cleveland or you'll die. Our economy's based on LeBron James. Buy a house for the price of a VCR. Our main export is crippling depression. We're so retarded that we think this is ours. It could be worse, though at least we're not Detroit! We're not Detroit!
Thank you. So from the movie Capitalism, a little tour of Cleveland. Love that song. Oh, boy. And, you know, LeBron is basically... sort of hijacked the entire NBA with this this signing, and you know, I guess if you care, it looks like he might be coming to my team, you know, the Knicks, which I was talking about last week because I was rudely interrupted by the BTR Gremlins. So we'll give you a little of this.
Go New York, go New York, go!
Too loud, man. Let's try that. All right. So we'll see if he comes through and he's here next week. We'll cover it a little bit. But it, from a cultural standpoint, you got to understand his profile. He's tugging on the heartstrings because LeBron James is a philo. So everything is about loyalty. Everything is about continuity. Everything is about feeling part of home. And the Cleveland organization played it up. They made a video for him. They used the cartoons he liked. I mean, they basically treated him like a 25-year-old overgrown kid, and he sucked it in. You know, he took the attention. But, you know, those little town blues and making the prospects of making $1 billion might change his mind, and I guess we'll find out tomorrow between 9 and 10 on the worldwide leader. Look at these Mets. All right, they're going to the ninth down 3-1. David Wright hits one off the fist to this this Viper at second base again. 7 hits for the Mets, a lot of guys left on. Nice pitched his heart out until the seventh inning, gave up a home run, and Brandon Phillips, that second baseman, dunked a C&I double over there down the right field line. He always hits the right field. We never learned this from this guy. Anyway, so the Mets might be going into the Braves series down three games as we hit the All-Star break. I'm doing like everything here. Weather, sports, news. All right. And meanwhile, the Phillies just got a run, so they're down by 3 with 2 at-bats left. Down the turnpike. Yeah, I just want to go a little bit about the weather. The way that the weather was reported this week, it's almost as if suffering is sexy. It's sponsored by so many things. If you watch the weather on any one of these, like, you know, detailed channels, whether it's Weather Channel or some of the local stations, they don't just, like, tell you, here's the temperature, here's the forecast. They go through chapter and verse, who's having a stroke, you know, who's passing out. And it almost like it anchors it in. And again, to me, it's part of the same scene. It's part of the same disconnect that we have between ourselves and our surroundings. The environment is always the threat, whether it's the BP environment, whether it's the financial environment, whether it's the healthcare environment, whether it's education. The environment always seems to be the scary, you know, boogeyman. And poor little old us are defenseless. So we need the protection from all these other things. To, you know, to ward off the inevitability of the environment consuming us. So whether it's, you know, and again, today, I can see if I can find that quick before Rushkoff calls in, about the climate gate. Talk about a whitewash with the climate gate guys. Let's see, I got questions coming in here. They cleared these guys of all, you know, fibs and lies, basically. You know, from the Climategate fallout, that it's just strange how nobody cares about that. These guys lied about all their data for 10 years, and now they're cleared, and nobody's going to kick their can again. See if I can find something about that. Because I just thought that was like it was like a passing thing. It was like nobody said anything. Now, let's see if I can find it here. Climategate. British panel criticizes Climategate but clears them. Now, how could the British panel clear them? That makes no sense. British report, let's see. From Fox News, of course it's true. A British report released Wednesday on the ClimateGate scandal criticizes a group of scientists for lack of transparency and other problems with how they presented their data, but concludes that their underlying scientific work is sound. Now, I don't know if that helps old Al Gore with the massage therapist situation, but this is amazing. 1,000 internal emails. The new report on the scandal found the experts' overall rigor and honesty are not in doubt. It's like, I'm telling you, it's an afterthought. These guys cooked the books, and they were part of the whole cap and trade thing, and it's like completely blown off. We're just so jaded. We don't care. I'm telling you. When you're sitting there in your apartment and it's 103 degrees and you know, Con Ed is brownouting everybody, you're not worried about this stuff. You're not worried about the Dubai, you know, situation with the BP guys making more money off you. You're not worried about the guys on Wall Street, you know, shorting MSG stock the day before LeBron, you know, comes across to the Knicks. Strange. We're burned out. We're completely burned out. We're fried. Let's see if I can, boy. I'm telling you guys, I'm doing the show with a kidney time behind my back here. So if I hit hear a noise like that, you know, you might want to call the office to see if I'm here. Wow. See if I have anything to add to that. Yeah. There's a little...
Bop! Boozy, boozy, bop! City bop!
That's all. That's all I have to say to that. All right. Let's see if I can close out the Facebook. And, you know, sorry about Germany today. You guys, Germany had, like, a lot of people jumping on the bandwagon this afternoon, my daughter included, you know. So we're going to get to a new World Cup champion on Sunday between the Netherlands and España. I watched the game, actually, on the Spanish television, so it was very cool. Go! I love it. That guy can narrate my life, actually. It'd be very nice if he did. There I go to the bank. Go! All right. And the Mets are going to the ninth, it looks like. Down by two. Boy, I'm a multitasking fool. All right. Okay, so, again, this LeBron thing is, to me, it's symbolic of where the culture is. We're so... And you listen to the George Carlin quote. I mean, we're so mired down in our own local stress that we can't really look up to see where there's anything to go because we look for diversions and distractions. It's a gossip thing. We're interested in it because it's there. It's candy. You know, there was a week of this stuff with all these millionaires going all over the place. You know. And anyone out there that knows about this new drug craze in the South with the Jolly Ranchers, the Sprite, and the codeine, if you have any information on it, either text me here in the chat room or give me a call. I want to learn about this because now you can be pulled over by a cop, and if he smells, you know, sugar on your breath, he could run you in and test your blood. Again, another one of those little layers of individual sovereignty that's eroding away, as the drug culture and the sort of police state mentality to control 300 million people who are mostly just trying to get from A to B continues to escalate. And to me, it's we're at the point now where stuff's going to start snapping, you know, and we're in Larchmont, you know, we're in a nice town.
It could be worse, though at least we're not Detroit! We're not Detroit!
There you go. Oh, boy. Ugh. So anyway, we got Rushkoff coming up here in a couple of minutes. I'm going to take a break and play you guys a little Miami music, I think. We'll play a little Congo, just in case LeBron decides to head down there, and I'm going to try and reboot my kidneys and get my voice back for the Sapevine with Douglas Rushkoff coming up here in about 5 minutes. Until then, everybody's dancing.
Let's go into the night, down by two.
Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga. No, you can't control yourself any longer. Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga. No, you can't control yourself any longer.
Precisely. Oh boy. I guess you can call now. It's 9:26. Let's hop on. Now is good. It's my guest, Douglas Rushkoff, author extraordinaire. He's going to explain a lot to us, I guess. Again, he's someone who's kind of stepped out of himself a little bit in terms of his focus, because, you know, for large part, if anyone's read any of his work, and you can see the links on the site there, a lot of it's been covering the evolution of the Internet. Now that the Internet's gone full circle and the corporate ethos has been completely uploaded onto the social networking platforms and all the social media, now you have a digital version of the corporate world. So, Mike Davis parks one off the wall at the Geico sign. And the Mets have a leadoff double. God, this guy can hit. Too bad they're down by two. Well, Mets come back. It'll be a nice little surprise for me. This guy can hit, man. He hit this thing around 415 feet right off the O in Geico. Wham! Another homo. So maybe we got a little comeback city here. That'll perk me up. You know? And again, I went through a lot during the 4th of July weekend that as far as what an American is, looking around at the people watching the fireworks, so we'll get into it. So here he is. Let's see. Hit the old save line. Okay. We're on this closed location in Lower, Westchester County. Joined now by author, expert, and mimetic engineer. You there? There you go.
I'm there.
So, did you guys get a brownout on your side of the county yet?
No.
As the Con Edisons, you know, they kind of cranked it down a couple days ago, and
I know. You're on the wealthy side of the county too.
Yeah. Well, anyone that kind of like that was east of the shoreline, they were fine. But anybody on this side of the post road, it was men's immense. As you know, you know, the caste systems are getting very. Very South American these days, as far as, like, where the lines are drawn, it's pretty obvious. The other side of the street literally is the other side of the street.
Yeah,
so,
it's pretty much as easy to see as the bars of reception on your cell phone.
Yeah, at this point, yeah. So what do you make of this? Because you could kind of fly over the culture from a different angle than most people do, because I don't know if you were one of the – it's like, you know, we have Neil Armstrong, first man on the moon. I don't know if there were many people in the early 90s that were taking on the Internet as the next technology, because it was so buried, it was so niched out, And by the time it sort of, like, you know, became mainstream, you know, mid to late 90s, it looked different than it started. In its larval stage was when you got interested in it. You're going back almost 20 years now. What do you make of the evolution of this, you know, sort of communication monster that runs parallel to our life down here on Earth?
Well, it's weird. I mean, I guess I originally looked at it, you know, idealistically as a maybe a new home for the collective brain, you know, in all the shades of optimism that ultimately clouded that period of my life. You know, I really thought that you know, people had kind of screwed up the real world, but you know, instead of having to go you know, fly off the planet onto another world, that here we were going to be able to build, you know, a model landscape. And if we didn't go exist there ourselves, we'd at least be able to model new kinds of behaviors and organization that then we'd bring back down to our regular old planet, and everyone could be happy again.
And
you know,
now, going back to when the idealistic thing hit the top of the roller coaster and we came across and started the plunge into the dot-com era, did you see the kind of ethos that Clinton brought in as part and parcel to sort of the, you know, hedonistic way that the web evolved, where there was, you know, all these companies just getting all kinds of funding and hedge funds were going wild? Did you anticipate that this was going to be like a candy store for a while, or did you think it would sort of self-police?
Well, you know, I get worried whenever a baby boomer gets involved in
whatever the baby boomers do, what? Are they running anything?
Even baby boomers get involved in any network. You know, I'm much more of a Gen Xer or a slacker by nature. And when Clinton came in, and during his you know, early years, he was doing a kind of massive, you know, financial support of Silicon Valley. And I remember John Sculley, who was then president of Apple, sitting next to Hillary Clinton at one of the State of the Unions. You know, it was as if, okay, we're behind this now. We're gonna make this real. And it was the day that it became real was the day that Netscape went public. You know, the first real browser went public, and that happened to be the same day that Jerry Garcia died.
Wow!
I always looked at it as a strange, strange but fitting coincidence that, you know, it really was the day the music died, and the day that the story of the internet really became less about what are we going to do together as a species and much more what is the next 20-something-year-old kid going to do to become a multimillionaire.
Mm. So, you know, today being another iconic birthday, Ringo Starr's birthday is today. So he's 70 years old. I mean, you want to really bury the 60s. Ringo's 70, guys. So I think this is another boomerism that glorifies the 60s. And co-ops them and uses them still to you know, I forget the movie I saw. Yeah, it was that Grown Ups movie, the Adam Sandler movie last weekend. All the songs were from, you know, from the early 70s, you know, kind of simpler times, and everything was innocent. But there was unbelievable things going on in the culture even back then that set this up. So how do we get sort of honest in the way that we reflect on what we did to this? Because it seems like every time, like you said, every time the boomers have been handed the keys to the car, they drive us off a cliff. And
well,
we just have to outlast these guys?
The boomers really are just the people that bought the sort of the story of the last 300 years. You know, they really, they believe stuff. They just believe. I mean, if I have a career goal, it's been to figure out why people believe stuff, particularly untrue stuff. And the boomers just loved believing, you know. And really, what happened economically right then is really what we're paying for right now. You know, when the internet was coming up, there had just been the biotech crash on Wall Street. There was a ton of money. It was kind of like now. There was a ton of money that was looking for a place to park itself. No one knew where to invest. And all of a sudden, it looked to them like, oh, the internet's going to be the great place to invest. So all this money started pouring into dot-coms that, ironically, didn't need money in order to grow. You know, if you've got, at that time even, you know, a $3,000 or $4,000 computer and a couple of hackers, you had a business. You didn't need hundreds of millions of dollars. But they really did, they were desperate to find a way to kind of kick some life back into capitalism, which was already fading, which was already decentralizing thanks to these great decentralizing technologies where everyone could do their own thing. So they turned the internet into really the poster child of NASDAQ. Everybody was investing tons of money in these companies that didn't need it. And, of course, eventually, you know, 4 or 5 years later, about March of 2000, that money all went away. Everything crashed. You know, the last person that sold those stocks got the money. Steve Case bought, you know, Time Warner with nothing, you know, with paper. And now, finally, we're paying the price for that. You know, Alan Greenspan and the Fed and these folks are pretty smart, and they managed to spread around that money in a kind of a fake real estate boom, but that was just a stopgap measure. You know, what we're really dealing with right now economically is the dot-com crash, finally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're forced to look at that and say, okay, there's all these people who've got all this money and they don't have anywhere to grow it, and they're not going to pay for that problem. They're going to make us pay for that problem one way or another.
No, so it's sort of like the BP spill, only it's digital, in the sense that here's a whole bunch of stuff that isn't worth anything. It for years it just continued to accumulate value without having to be, you know, accountable to anybody, and now all of a sudden the bill came through.
Right. The bill comes through, and we are still so well trained that when they say, oh, well, look, we can't make BP go bankrupt because there's a lot of people whose, you know, pensions and stock funds are depending on BP, what they're doing is saying, well, BP is too big to fail. You know, they get us, you know, they get us from the other side, so we start to actually think, oh, well, we better not let them go bankrupt. I guess it is better for us to bail this out than to let that thing fall. When we don't accept responsibility for the fact that we're the ones investing in an oil company, you know, we're the ones who are old enough to remember Exxon Valdez and who should understand that if you're going to put your retirement in a stock, in an oil stock, then you're going to, I mean, the reason you're getting these returns is because there's also some risk. Well, this is the risk.
Wow. So in a real sense, you know, and this goes back to a couple of other points in your arc as far as documenting this in your books, is that we believed in this sort of pseudo-parent that the government was going to be, or the banks were going to be, or Big Pharma was going to be, and they were dysfunctional parents, and they basically abused the whole generation of people that didn't question them. Remember the question authority thing from the 60s? What happened to that?
Mm-hmm.
Did we just want to become authority so much that we became sort of like mute, that we didn't want to question it because, you know, everybody was getting fat and happy, so no one wanted to call, you know, say, hey, you know, we got a little bit of a problem here. Anyone that was a whistleblower was basically treated just like anyone that questioned the war, or anyone that questioned policy, was treated like a crackpot and an outsider. And
eventually, though, question authority became kind of the rallying cry of the Reagan Democrats.
Right.
As if, you know, now we're going to fight big government and fight all these parent figures, when really what they were doing was reinstating, you know, authoritarian government.
So how do we get, if we realize all this stuff intellectually now, and I watch a lot of the Obama, wonks there, who try to basically make everything logical here, when a lot of this stuff happens on impulse and emotion, and there's not a lot of reasoning going on. How do we get people to center themselves and claim, you know, reclaim some of their value? Because it just seems like you're saying, that the horse is out of the barn. The internet can't go back to being, you know, a corporate free environment, an open source environment, a cooperative environment. Little pockets of it might be, but anytime it builds up any type of eyeballs, if someone comes along and just, you know, puts the claw in and takes it over. So how do you, if you're sitting in your kitchen and you're saying, I want to start, you know, getting people aware, like I see a lot of stuff on Facebook, it's like, oh, sign this petition. It just seems like that narrative has lost a lot of steam, because even though we have the numbers, we don't have the influence. So how do you, on an individual basis and then on a collective basis, how do you basically usurp this when it's omnipresent?
That's funny. I mean, you know, I've been working on this one for like 20 years, and I remember maybe 10, 15 years ago, my grandmother listening to me, you know, spout on about all this, and her finally saying, well, do successful people buy your books? I understood what she was saying. In other words, if people are basically able to get ahead in life by subscribing to the belief system that we think is so wrong. If a whole bunch of people can still do that, then those are the people that are going to run the earth, you know. But if it's a majority of people, then how dare we say that that's not even the way it should be, you know? Why should we be the ones shouting that we're about to go off a cliff? Fact is, though, we do tend to act. We do tend to change our beliefs when stuff hits the fan. You know, that this right now, I mean, this is like, you know, when someone gets some big illness, you know, and they go into your office and you can be like, mm-hmm. all right, finally, you know. It's because
right.
you've been living like this and thinking like this and doing like that. But the bad thing almost has to happen for us to be able to grow. You know,
so we're like addicts then, in a way. We have to hit rock bottom in order to be powerless enough to start regaining our power. Otherwise, we'll keep, just like a credit card, you know, we'll just keep extending it and extending it until basically we can't recover anymore. So,
right. It seems
in healthcare, that's another issue because we've been indoctrinated in basically, you know, palliative care, symptomatic care, kick the can kind of care, whether it's obesity or heart disease or any of these big fish, cancer, we get more invasive in our testing, and we're gonna prevent the inevitable, and we're gonna make better X-rays and better MRIs, and we still live the same way. So it's just
right.
me, it's just a granular picture of a more detail of the same pathology that's sort of like embedded in the way that we live. So what's the difference if we have more detail?
The perfect storm that's coming now is not only are regular people increasingly in a position to question, you know, whether their money is real and whether the
uh-huh.
things that they think that they're working for are valid and whether there's any institution that's really going to bail them out. While that's happening, we also have a perfectly ignorant upper class, that we finally have bankers, economists, and even monetary policymakers. We have a Fed who don't understand the basic fictions about money and fiscal policy. They
uh-huh.
don't. They actually believe that the money we use was invented to help people transact. You know, they don't know the history. They don't understand that there were a lot of monies around at one time to help people transact, and then this kind of money, centrally issued bank, you know, debt money, was invented for a very different purpose. It was invented to stop economic activity and to promote the really congealing of money in wealthy people's places. It was an invention to help rich people make money by having money. And it worked, but it got to the point now where wealthy people and corporations have more money than they know what to do with. The great financial data to look at is the fact that corporate earnings, you know, actual corporate profit over corporate net worth has been going down for the last 30 or 40 years, you know,
mm-hmm.
so that the amount of money that's in the companies is very big, but their ability to earn money for each dollar that they're worth is getting smaller and smaller and smaller because they just kept all the money and didn't promote actual economic activity. So they're starving themselves. They don't even get it. And because they don't get it, we have a golden opportunity to rebuild an economy from the bottom up. You know, the same way the failures of top-down allopathic medicine give
uh-huh.
us an opportunity to say, okay, here's this other way. You know, we can actually promote life instead of just cutting things off, and it might actually work. They're confused enough at the top now that we can kind of get away with gathering and sharing information and just doing stuff. You know, my insurance is too expensive. My deductible is too much. I can't go to the doctor anyway. He doesn't know how to find me anyway. So it's actually become easier for me to go to the thing that I'm not supposed to go to.
So if you squeeze all that frustration, you know, basically into a collective, and it spills out as Tea Party, you know,
yeah.
this sort of, you know, this kind of like rolling tumbleweed of disorientation and confusion and misinformation. And on the other side, you know, you look at the progressive movement, which is almost to a fault. They're intellectually honest to a fault when they're dealing with people that aren't playing square with them, and
right.
and their mentality is to sort of take the higher road, to turn the other cheek, and they just keep getting beat up.
So how do you get the truth, which we seem to kind of extracted the truth from this, but how do you act on the truth when the players are so distorted, where you have a bunch of crazed, you know, teabaggers that are just run around, you know, in revolutionary garb and gather and protest and you know, wave a snake at you. And on the other side, you have a bunch of, you know, academic elitist types that are traditional, you know, liberal types that just want to win the argument. They don't necessarily want to change the policy or get their hands dirty. So you've got a lot of people passing the buck and a lot of people basically running at the walls. Is there a happy medium in between where we can actually get some effective change, or are we just kind of ride this thing out like, you know, like you were talking about before, where someone goes holistic because the allopathic model finally fully fails them and they go, okay, you know, they put their hand up and say help.
Well, what the teabaggers and the unfortunately and the liberal progressives have in common now is their shared faith, and yes, they both have faith that somehow retaking government is going to save things. You know, the worst thing that could happen to the progressives was getting someone who was nominally progressive in the White House, because now all of a sudden, oh well, we kind of want to support government because, well, Obama's in there, so it means that presidents can actually do things. But in fact, presidents can't actually do things. The entire political system, as we know, is owned by corporate lobbies. It's paid for. So the most of the effort of teabaggers is still to get their people into those offices, and of progressives is to get, you know, our people into office. And I think that political office is no longer the place where the kind of change we need happens. It just doesn't work. Even a well-meaning, you know, senator or congressman who's trying to somehow level the playing field ends up creating a legislative, you know, nightmare where, you know, big agro or big corporations or big, you know, big medicine just further their grip. I mean, look at healthcare. You know, how does this help?
So again, you're dealing with this paradox of we want government to protect us from the abuse of corporations when they're in bed with them, and then when we get the guy we want, who's going to, you know, on the inside, who's going to, like, correct it from the inside. We got a guy down in D.C. He's going to take care of us, and he's swallowed up in the same, you know, gridlock, and he can't effectively make anything change because, as he found out almost immediately when he came in with the stimulus package, you know, nobody was shooting straight with him, and it happened again with the BP thing. And I don't know if it was, again, that intellectual honesty that says, you know, I'm going to play fair, I'm going to take the high road, you guys are dirty and conniving businessmen, evil businessmen, I'm going to be the statesman here and take the hit. And it's sort of like a toxicity in a sense that it spreads to the guy that we think is going to help us. Now he starts sharing the blame. I think the polls are pretty much split now between who's responsible for the cleanup and, you know, why wasn't there military intervention early on? He waited about 50 days to, you know, to really do anything. So going forward, forget the BP thing for a minute, just going to the midterms, if you're saying that, like I was playing George Carlin before, if elections are nothing more than a symbolic farce, a banana republic kind of a thing, we're going through the motions because no single politician can really, you know, lead it, you know, we can't go back to that, what's the lever? Is it you're back to social media? Where are you going to get the leverage to actually, you know, regain some influence here? Because we're kind of running out of time.
I think the entire construction of wanting to somehow change the system, of to make some sweeping change, or to figure out what movement we need to create, what banner we need to get under, is itself the booby prize. I think the only way to really do this, and I mean, I'm partly learning this experientially, you know, by working with you as my as my health practitioner too. It's incremental. It's really, and it's local. I think the only way for people to do it is to get back in their own body, in their own family, in their own neighborhood. You know, the way to fix the BP spill long term is not to pass a law. The way to fix it long-term is not to be driving so much, and the reason not to be driving so much is because you work locally and because you have friends locally and because instead of, you know, instead of buying your Swiss chard at the Safeway or the Pathmark where it has to get shipped in from Big Agra. You're buying it from a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture Group, in your neighborhood. That it's these little changes that seem stupid and meaningless that really do scale up. You know, and I really believe most people can do so much more in their moment-to-moment decisions, you know, by becoming by kind of rescaling their existence to the local level. And if they are going to get involved in politics, then get involved in real politics, which just means removing the obstacles to you doing what it is you want to do. So you want a solar panel on your roof, and it turns out that the energy company is regulated in a way that you're not allowed to do it. That's something your state legislature is going to be interested in. That's something that your legislator can actually work on. Or you find out, as we did with our CSA, that they're not allowed to grow anything but corn in the new field they bought because of an old corn lobby subsidy nonsense. That's something that you can go and actually fight for a lot easier than you can try to get, you know, Del Monte out of Wisconsin or something.
Do you see the government sensing that and going more to state regulations, like for vaccines, making things more mandatory, the paranoia that we're going to, you know, have chips in our body and they're going to make money illegal and we're going to be going to, you know, to local currencies that are off the grid? Do you see it becoming like, because I always had this Mad Max kind of apocalyptic thing of like, if the government senses that we figured it out, you know, like any autoimmune condition, it'll consume us and themselves because of the lack of control. 300 million people wake up at once, it could be trouble. So do you think it's one of those situations where it'll be sort of an undercurrent of sort of people breaking free and literally dropping off the grid? And I just see that as almost kind of a consolation prize, because if the only way to sort of affect change is to leave the system and operate sort of parallel to it, you're always a fringe player because you're always counterculture to the people that are stuck basically in the sheep mentality, thinking that the government's going to protect you, the healthcare system's going to take care of you, and the educational system's going to make you smart. You know,
right?
I mean,
I don't know.
It's a community thing more.
I do. I mean, I do think it's a community thing. I think that you know, government draws power off this notion of individuality. You know, that's you draw the boundary around yourself or around your family. And, you know, both corporations and government draw power off that, because for corporations it means every family has to buy its own everything, its own snowblower even, rather than sharing it with the other people on the block. And for government, it means that people aren't really relating to them as anything but individuals with individual votes. You know, and that's perfect for powerlessness. It's not a natural or fun way to be. I mean, you get your own widescreen TV and your own this and your own that, and then you're on your own. You know, and it turns out that the thing we thought we wanted to have is the worst thing of all. It's isolation and barriers between, you know, anyone who can help us make meaning.
Yeah, and it used to be the Steve Jobs, phrase of them with the most toys wins, you know, back in the 80s. And, of course, he comes out with the iPad and people are tripping over themselves to get this thing, which I always find is, again, it's sort of paradoxical. It's like here's everybody basically leveraged to their eyeballs. Property values are still not too good. And you've got an economy that the unemployment numbers are not too good, and you've got underemployment. And yet everybody still wants their toys. Is it just like a systemic immaturity that we don't want to say, like the elephant in the room is us, that we're so toxic from the exposure that there's like an addiction to materialism. The corporatism kind of feeds off of that, like, you know, slugs to beer, and we're kind of caught up in this lottery mentality that there's a shortcut. I don't want to be a sucker and work really hard and produce something. I'm gonna look for this shortcut. I forget which book it was. You talk about reducing life to chutes and ladders, the old game. And it's like I think people are rolling the dice looking for that ladder. Instead of a ladder to climb up corporately because we flattened all the organizations, we're looking for a way to become sort of individuated and almost kind of impervious to things. So we're almost kind of digital islands. That it's the brand me thing and that thing you talk about in Life, Inc. of corporatizing our identity so that you look at what's going on with LeBron the last week or so. Mm-hmm. Here's a guy who, you know, he's 25 years old. He didn't go to college. He's been playing basketball for 7 years. He's surrounded by his you know, basically his childhood friends. That's like the Entourage show. And they're running the entire NBA on a string. And they've got, you know, guys like James Dolan and these billionaires, you know, flying into Akron to sort of bring him gifts and make vanity videos for him and woo him, literally, to come to their team. Because, again, it's all about the stock. It's all about, like I found before that down on Wall Street today, there was a run on MSG stock today. People are basically selling it short, thinking that he's coming to the Knicks tomorrow. They're going to cash in on it. People are bird dogging a bunch of season tickets because they're going to be able to resell them. So there's almost like everybody is sort of a pinata. And if you can attach yourself to some hot brand and sort of ride that wave, it is like Easy Rider. You get your money and you get out, and then you're insulated. Once you have enough money, it's the Howard Stern rule. There's money, there's F me money, and then there's F you money. And everybody
right.
wants the F you money so no one can hurt them anymore. No one can take anything away anymore. So we're all in this pursuit, not of happiness, but of sort of financial immortality. Like, no one can touch me. Like, you see what happened in the fallout of Tiger Woods last week. You know, he gets hit with a $750 million divorce settlement. And, you know, he can't get a golf ball straight. He doesn't know what to do with himself because he completely designed his life, and he's XO, if you guys are keeping score at home, you know, very structural. And that structure, that facade, that corporate brand is gone. And he left the country this week to get ready for the British Open, and the British press basically asked him a very easy question: Tiger, was it worth it? And he completely, the facade came off, and he cut the interview off because, you know, God forbid the human in there that's absolutely just, you know, in a deer in the headlights trauma, can't speak. Only the corporate persona can speak. So talk about how, since that's still the carrot and stick, you know, kind of paradigm we're in, if we're always going to be searching for something outside ourselves to make ourselves sort of, like I said, financially immortal, that no one could take our stuff away, and we're still looking for toys, instead of connection, instead of, as you talk about community, real community, almost a tribal thing, where we bypass religion and culture and age and all these other things, all these, you know, these kind of spiritually evolved things. I don't think we're very spiritually evolved. How do we get on that path when the stick is whacking us in the head and the carrot is a dot on the horizon?
Well,
kind of a bleak picture, but
yeah, but that's, I mean, that experiencing that bleakness can help people get off that treadmill. I mean, first thing they have to realize is no matter how good they are or think they are at doing it, maybe at best, you know, 5 to 10%, and it's a shrinking percent,
mm-hmm.
will be able to do whatever it is that will allow them to insulate themselves from the world. I mean, the more of us are engaged in the process of trying to make enough money so that we can insulate ourselves from our world, the worse our world actually gets, and the more money we need to pull off the insulation equation. You know, so if everybody is sending their kids to private school, then the public schools get worse, and then you have to send your kid to private school, they're going to get killed in the public school. You know, and
right.
It's the same with everything. If you, by the time you get a good enough gates and guards and guard dogs in your compound, you know, then you really better not leave that compound, and you better be able to support those dogs, or the hooligans are coming over and they're going to kill you. And so,
wow.
So once you realize that this is a losing game, that you not only can you not probably insulate yourself from the world successfully, but that it's not even a fun way to live if you do it. If you do succeed at it,
yeah.
Then the only alternative is to say, well, then how do I make the actual world a place that I don't have to insulate myself from? You know, if bad things are really going to happen, and I would argue financially, we haven't seen the recession or depression yet, that we just got a hint. We just got a warning about what is coming. This wasn't it. You know, it's not that we get a second dip. It's that we didn't even get the dip.
Yeah. So one of my Wall Streeters said, he goes, what happened to us in 08 was the equivalent of leaving a very good party and handing our keys to the valet parking guy, and we're waiting for our car. And then, you know, so the first hit was basically that we're standing on the curb and someone took our car keys, and that was like the first dip. And then when he comes back and says he stole our car and it's not coming back,
yeah.
that's when the phantom pain will begin, because
I mean, Biden even said it, that some of these jobs, and I think in a good way, are not coming back.
Right.
I don't want financial, planners and all these other guys that were sitting on Wall Street, making all these bets against us, to come back. I don't. Do you want to go back to that? I the same thing with the oil industry. It's a very push pull kind of a thing because you are pointing at real people that have real concerns, and I guess some of them come in here and get on my table,
right.
But they don't have a strategy for an Act Three where a creative and intelligent and sort of an innovative culture can discard things that no longer serve the collective. But everybody's so schooled in me, and me versus you, and it better be me, that we're having this sort of like West Side Story thing play out where me and my gang are going to get you, and that's why you see it, within politics and definitely within healthcare. It's the Wu versus the Moo, and who's going to get their big brother to beat you up, So how do we, going into the next phase of this, say we come out of the BP thing and they finally get these relief wells built and we could stop watching the oil come out every morning and just make you nauseous, and we move on to, well, what's going to happen next? Is it going to be to you? You already said policy is sort of pablum. They don't even pay attention to policy. Is it, and the elections in the fall are another kind of like little cottage industry, little circus. Is it going to be when we go to the store and there's nothing and there's that we say, wow, we should have paid attention? Do we have to have that sort of like epiphany, apocalyptic epiphany that Planet of the Apes, where it's like, or are we going to be able to be as a culture self-aware enough to communicate before we go over the falls? I kind of look at it like it isn't about survival in the sense, because we're not talking about, a war-torn country where we've got dictators and warlords running around. This isn't Afghanistan. It's Newark. So it's like, is it going to be a situation where, because there's so many people that have been treated unfairly, oppressed, and kind of gobbled up by the system, that the system basically gets sort of disemboweled, where, like, you're looking at almost like what happened in downsizing in the late 80s, we downsize them. Like, we just leave. We just stop participating in something that no longer really has it. Like, I deal with my friend Mike Silver on the show a lot. He works for Philip Morris, a cigarette company, right? Mm-hmm. And imagine working for tobacco with all the press against them. He has to train the sales guys to go sell, cigarette machines to these bodegas, out on the East End of Long Island where they're all the granola crunchers are, right? So he gets yelled at from both directions, from his people above him, people on his level, and people out in the field. And it's like, well, this company still makes tons and tons of money, but he'll get squeezed because it didn't meet the quarterly expectation, and he'll get squeezed for, a couple hundred thousand dollars when millions are being, parlayed at the poker game upstairs. So he's like, well, what's my incentive of doing a good job when I don't believe in the product, I don't believe in the structure, and I don't believe I'm ever going to get anything out of this? But he's tied to it because he's leveraged, he's got a mortgage, he's got a family. There's no way to jump off the ship and do sort of a tuck and roll and sort of MacGyver this thing because we're sort of tied to it. And generationally, the next generation coming through, they're cohabitating, they're not getting married as much, they're more liberal in the way that they use their social relationships, they don't tie them to business as much, they're more interested in the shortcuts, they're looking for those ladders, avoiding the chutes. Is it going to be a Generation Y kind of thing, that those guys get out and us Xers and Boomers are like, those poor guys in the wave in Ten Commandments when the ocean comes back? It seems like we're going to be sacrificed in a way.
Yeah, well, we're going to be sacrificed. Boomers always make it under the wire somehow. I mean, boomers are magic, and they believe to the end, and they click their heels, and somehow they get their retirement and their golf course. Gen X are screwed. I mean, because by the time the culture at large wakes up to the injustice and the way retirement and healthcare and everything else is being distributed, that's when our generation is going to be needing it. So it's going to be taken out on us for 10 years. I am sometimes optimistic about, Gen Y or Gen Z, whatever they're called, and their ability to to feel okay about the fact
that they're never going to get any Social Security, that there are no retirement plans for them, that there's no such thing as job security. They don't expect it, then they don't ask for it. And that's a much healthier way to be employed. And I think they're even a generation that might be ready to accept the fact that not everyone needs a job. You know, the reason we need jobs is to pay for stuff. We don't need jobs to make enough stuff for everybody to have. There's probably 10-20% of us could be employed full-time and take care of everybody else's needs. You know, the only problem is what do the other 80% of people do to demand, you know, food to eat, you know, that they haven't worked for.
Well, their entitlement is much more on the level of status. That's why, while maybe you can divide it up like a pie, the boomers and the Gen Xers, you know, are watching this LeBron James thing with their typical jaded outlook of, you know, here's the corporate ESPN, you know, making a spectacle out of this thing. And the Ys, you know, the ones behind it, born in the 80s, they don't even tune into it. He's a video game player. That's all he is to them. And he's a fantasy, a stat geek guy that maybe helps their fantasy team. They live in the fantasy world, basically. And they're upset about Lindsay Lohan going to jail. That's what they're upset about. Those are their heroes, their icons. And how dare they, you know, leave Britney alone. Their mentality is much, much more in that kind of reality TV, kind of carnival atmosphere where everything basically ends in a half an hour, 22 minutes and 8 minutes of commercials, and there is no consequence. They live in almost a cyclical, kind of chronoscopic perspective, and when you talk to them about intent and consequences, they stare at you because their neurology isn't programmed to think linear.
No.
Think about it.
And it's interesting, when they do something bad online and are discovered for it, you know, Sherry Turkle at MIT figured this out, they don't say, I'm sorry. They say,
no.
They confess. They go, yes, I did that, you know, but they don't say I'm sorry, as if the factual confession is what matters. But there's no actual penitence. There's no sorrow. They don't apologize.
Yeah, and again, because that would be giving up some of the turf, and it used to be on the web you were anonymous, and you could have, you know, 50 different pseudo identities, and that's why MySpace basically became, like, you know, the Catch a Predator. And when Facebook came out, and then when Google, like you wrote about, I think it was Daily Beast, one of those, when Google co-opted Facebook and made you, like, pick your page with your name, mm-hmm. so they could just, like, you know, come right at you, and look at all the things that were going on Facebook with security and everything else. We want that vanity plate. It's like, you know, in the 80s you had a license plate that said Cool Dude on it. It was like a big deal. And now Cool Dude is your Facebook page, and you can comment on things and have an audience and have that perception, almost like Rupert Pupkin, have that perception of power without really having to go through any kind of meritocracy to get it. So
right.
No
and
credibility,
as long as,
just visibility.
And as long as you're stuck there doing that, then no one has to worry about you engaging with your neighbors or actually doing anything in real life that's going to wake you up.
Right, you've dehumanized the whole thing. It's just basically an exchange process. You say, I'm gonna talk about, you know, whatever I'm passionate about, because it's all about me, and I'm gonna point to myself, and I'm gonna basically make this molehill in the clouds, and include and exclude, kind of like a bouncer at the Studio 54. I'm gonna put my velvet rope up, and I'm gonna sort for the people I want to talk to, and sort of customize my little digital universe. And I'll unfriend you or whatever they call it. And it's like it becomes very catty very quickly. And like you said, because of the dehumanization and the lack of consequences and apologies being very superficial, almost flippant, there is no connection. There's just a lot of sort of communal froth up there, but you couldn't organize them to walk down the street together. They're too busy individuating and developing their persona and their brand because that's what they were told to do by, you know, the media itself.
Right, they're so wrapped up, unfortunately, in the illusion of cyberspace that they can't see the fact that they're sitting alone in their bedroom at
right.
night on a computer.
Forget about that. They're on their phone. You know, I was watching 4th of July fireworks over here in Mamaroneck by the town center, and the crowd was basically demographically probably about 60%, you know, 35 and older, and 40% 35 and other, with a couple little kids. But all the tweens and the teens in their early 20s, they weren't really watching the fireworks. They were texting that they were watching the fireworks, or they were videoing watching the fireworks. They weren't sitting there watching the fireworks. And it was like, I commented to one of the kids. I was like, I said, don't you just want to watch this? And the kid looked at me again, like I get that blank stare a lot. But why would I want to do that? Why do you think I came here? I came here because my friend couldn't come here. So in a way, that's the way of connecting, is to sort of, I got this, you didn't, check it out. And it's not a sharing. It's sort of a na-na-na-na-na mentality. And whoever got better pictures, or it becomes like that's the contest. It's all about the icing, no cake. And so, you know, when I got up to leave, it was like a parade of these 15 to 25-year-olds walking down the hill, bumping into each other because they were still, you know, texting along.
Right.
You know, and not even talking to each other. Even though they sat on the hill for 40 minutes together, nobody really engaged anybody. So how could you have a generation that really cares about their neighbor or their coworker or anybody that interacts with them in the community, the people they bump into on the street, when you have that sort of selective, you know, kind of ethos that kind of, I hate to say it, capitalizes on the technology. And then we get into the whole discussion of teams versus memes, and then we're off to the races here, where it's actually programming the brain. So the next generation, I mean, I don't know how many kids I had in my family born this spring to, you know, relatives in their 20s that basically was a YouTube, you know, sort of a birthing process with tweets when they're dilating. And it's like, you know, play-by-play. It's like there's no sense of privacy. There's no sense of I'm documenting everything that happens to me, and you should care. And it's sort of a programming that says it isn't about you. It's about you perceiving me doing something cooler than you are right now, and then you have to return serve and find something cooler.
If you're a genuine, progressive, loving lefty, then you get the tweet and you feel bad that you don't care that they're at 9 centimeters.
right, exactly. Yeah, it's like the War Games movie. The only solution is not to play. It's tic-tac-toe with the chicken. You know, I'm fascinated with how it's almost like it's catnip. They can't ignore it. It used to be that you'd be able to have an email conversation with somebody that had some discontinuity to it. That you could respond, that you could avoid voicemail, you know, and then we went to IM, and then we went to texting, and it just seems now, if you know, you've taught in some of the colleges around here, how do you engage a classroom of 20-somethings who are going to be out in the work, you know, force, when they're sitting in a classroom literally 10 feet from you, and they're completely ignoring you? You're like on a TV to them. You're not there in the room. There's no physical or somatic awareness that. You know, there's a guy standing in front of you. It's like you're just appearing, and you're just there to kind of do dinner theater while I text things. How do you undo that?
I make them get up and act. I do 4 weeks of acting exercises with them before I lecture to them. Just so they have all performed and been a little kinesthetic, you know, with each other. I mean, what you're talking about in terms of the technology, I mean, that's just what I'm writing about now, is our inability to recognize the biases of the technology. Now, the great thing about the early internet was that it was an asynchronous medium, you know, that it was like chess by mail. You could take as long as you wanted to reply to something.
Right.
Even if you were on a bulletin board, a conversation's going on, the conversation happens for months, you know, and the temptation as the technology has developed has been to turn it from an asynchronous medium into an always-on medium, so that your phone and everything vibrates the minute that anyone has anything to say about anything, and you have so much incoming that you need to respond as quickly as possible just to shovel out your inbox. You know, and so the consideration that characterized the early internet, it used to be a place where you had deeper thought than you got to have in the real world, because you could think longer and harder about stuff in that no time space, is now, it feels like it's happening very rapidly, but it's not. It's still a completely discontinuous dead space, just happening very frequently, you know, or very rapidly. And that's not a healthy place to be. That's why we're experiencing things like, you know, phantom thigh syndrome, where people actually feel their cell phone ringing in their thigh, even though it's not even on their person and it's not even ringing.
Wow.
The teams have taken over, man.
So give us a little bit, because we mentioned, I just kind of threw teams out there as a frisbee, but most people are going to go, what the hell is a team? It's a technological version of an idea. So, you know, an iPhone is a team. It's a completely sort of self-contained technology that has an ability to have a database on you and actually literally program the way you act. And then the next step down is memes, which are these cultural ideas that we continue to share. So talk about how your experience in neuromarketing 10 years ago and some of the things that were evolving during the dot-com era, how are you applying it now when you have a new institute opening up that's going to be consulting on this, especially when it comes to the foreign governments and economies?
Well, I mean, I originated this phrase, media virus or viral media,
mm-hmm.
you know, back in the way early 90s. And it turned into this very different thing, viral marketing. And there's a ton of people out there making a whole lot of money off it, not even scratching the surface of what it is. I mean, without even reading the entirety of my book. So they go around thinking that, you know, hamster dance or you know, anything that people are talking about is viral media and that's it. And they're going to go to companies and corporations and governments and show them how to be viral. And not only is that stupid, but it misses the point and the potential power of really working with memes to really improve our world through nonfiction rather than through mythologies. You know, we've had centuries of marketers persuading people with stories. And now that we're in such an interactive, almost Twitterverse of information, it turns out that it's facts that spread, even if they're stupid facts, Tiger Woods and
right.
the lady dies run over, whatever it is, it's still tidbits, facts, rumors that are spreading. And the ones that nest in our consciousness and replicate well are the ones that really exploit our cultural immune deficiencies. And when I look at it sounds awful, but when I look at our society being stupid, I realize that it's actually pretty easy to convince them of what they should actually believe and understand by sharing with them facts in a way that they can digest them. You know, by sharing memes. You know, so what I'm going to be doing with what I'm calling now the Institute for Applied Memetics is really collecting all of the memes that have to do with a certain thing and then helping a government or an organization, ideally some good NGO, to express themselves through both what they say and what they do and to be able to do it in a way that's consistent with the meme map, you know, or the memescape out there. You know, and it's not rocket science. It ends up being crazy simple because the main recommendation that will almost always come back is, oh, well, if you want to be a successful company, then actually just make good stuff. Or if you want to get that environmental vote, then why don't you do stuff that's good for the environment? You know, or if Israel, you want to be looked at as less, you know, repressive to the Gaza, then maybe one way to do that is to be less repressive to Gaza. And by demonstrating this memetically, you know, by really what I'm trying to do is prove to organizations that doing the right thing is the right thing, you know, and if I can give them enough evidence that this is the case, and memetics really is basically evidence that people are thinking in certain ways,
right.
you know, then hopefully we can improve some of the world. So rather than just teaching a country or a company how to brand their product better, it's really a matter of telling them why doing the thing that they actually wanted to do in the first place, you know, the real thing, you know, even what BP wanted to do, to get beyond petroleum, why that would have been a good thing to actually try to do.
Well, so basically, instead of operating on the shell of the theater of Western selling, I guess you would call it, where, you know, every car dealership is waving a flag and everybody's, you know, that jingoistic kind of over-the-top stuff, this is you're trying to engender a soulful way of communicating with the public so that there is a transparency, there is an accountability, and there's more action than there is words. Because all I ever see, whether it's bureaucracy and government or education or definitely healthcare, is a lot of backswing and very little follow-through, and then everybody points fingers.
Right.
So talk less, act more, figure it out as you go, and basically build up your sort of sweat equity, if you will, because of the fact that you consistently do the things that feed the culture with energy and with innovation. And again, you're back to the intellectual honest against the brutal. That it does seem, I don't want to say it's far-fetched, but right now we're sitting in such a quagmire that it's like the Billy Joel song "Honesty" is playing in the background on an old LP, you know, scratchy record, and it's like, yeah, why don't we just come clean? And no one wants. You talk about the millennials not wanting to apologize. Hardly any generation has ever really apologized and meant it and had consequences for it and sort of, you know, in a very poetic way, rectified the mistakes they made. They just kick it to the next generation. And I don't think the generation behind the Xers, like you said, they don't care. They'll let the whole thing burn to the ground. Their mentality is almost uber local, even though they live in that Twitterverse, like you said. So I don't know if we can rely on those guys, you know, on the train car behind us. But the few boomers and the few Xers out there that are awake and kind of looking out the window need to communicate more. And definitely with your company. Is there a website we can give people to go to here?
Not yet, really. I mean, I got a phone number on.
Okay.
I'm just so sick of the web.
Yeah,
I'm doing the whole thing.
Just go to archbox.com and contact information.
Yeah, and find out about me and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, man. So, you know, I think we kind of laid out a blueprint that if people were paying attention, they might actually hear this and start, I don't want to say question authority, but at least they'll be curious about what authority really is and do they have it for themselves. And you've given them a couple of
things
to get it back to themselves.
And honestly, it's crazy easy to start. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just make one choice, and then all the other choices ripple out from that. You know, it's maybe harder a little bit further down the line, but then you're further down the line, so you can meet the new challenge. You know, it's so easy that it's sick. You know,
right.
And it's so easy that no one believes it's really as easy as it is. You know, you don't even have to believe anything. You don't have to accept a savior. You don't have to sign anything.
Right.
You just start living your life the way you actually want to live it. And believe me, the challenges will arise in perfect time.
Well, thanks for sharing this all. And, you know, maybe we can get on in 6 months and see if we can take care of the pedestal of complexity in one fell swoop. And thanks for joining us on Summertime again. Rushcroft.com.
Thanks for doing it.
And we'll see you soon, man.
All right. Be good.
Take care. All right. So there you go. Rushkoff has laid down some smack. All right. Let's see. We can kind of sew this up with a little 60s hymn. A little Woodstock hymn, babies. Because this old eco is at it. The Braves won. The Mets lost. We got LeBron-a-thon tomorrow. You know. We have to tune into that. And, you know, just to sum up his thoughts a little bit, there's definitely an innocent answer out there for him that he's providing you. And if I always say you start with getting your attention back inside your breath. You start by becoming alive inside again. And then a lot of the other limitations, that fear of mortality, that all the survival stuff that you've internalized, it doesn't look as scary anymore. But people are so reluctant to look within because they don't know what's in there. So they look outside themselves for solutions when the greatest social media you have is the community of cells and atoms and quarks and leptons running around inside your body. So check us out, somaspace.org, and we will be back again on the 14th, 9 o'clock. I'm not sure where we're going, but we'll get there as soon as we can. And until then, this is Dr. Mark saying travel light through the darkness. And now a little Janice.
I'd like to do a song of great social and political import. It goes like this. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me? is trying to find me. I wait for delivery each day until 3. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Oh Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? I'm counting on you, Lord. Please don't let me down. Prove that you love me and buy the next round. Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? Everybody, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? That's it.
Spiral on, Sapiens.